Welcome, everyone. Warm welcome, our old and new friends and colleagues of our SDG Bond Network, people who we have been partnering with our research project, Education for Emergencies, that is now all merged into a network called CloseNet. Cultivating change through global and sustainable education. And today, this is the official opening of our CloseNet network, and we hope that all of you here in Ruusupuisto and also online will stay with us and will join our network. And before we get started today's event, we have a pleasure to have our Dean, Anna-Maija Poikkeus, to open our CloseNet network and today's guest talk. Good morning, or good day, I should say. It's a good time to start with some welcoming words. Very happy to see so many of you here, excited to launch together this community. We feel that this is a special occasion. Heidi asked me to tell a little bit about the history, and of course the long history of SDG4 seminar. I'm sure very many of you have been participants in that seminar. It has been something that we have felt that it's one of the highlights of the year, and it's so invigorating and so exciting event to sort of have people together on themes of interest to all of us and which are very topical. So I think Heidi has had the idea that for a long time that we should have this more the permanent, more sustainable activity, some kind of a binding network that can sort of help us to find each other. So my name is Anna-Maija Poikkeus, and I'm working currently as Dean of the Faculty, and I'm happy to say that also in our faculty, the theme of sustainability, its many forms, cultural, social, also economical, but also, of course, environmental sustainability. They are one of the key areas of our sort of strategy at this moment. And that's why we have had already for some time arranged events and had the sort of encouragement of feeling empowered that many people are interested in the topics, but we would like to have more sort of this kind of opportunities to work together. The acronym of GLOSE with the letter G stands for Global and Sustainable Education, of course, but it can also remind us that global issues, crises, conflicts and conditions which produce inequality, racism or injustice are not somewhere there, somewhere far away. They can be very close to us, and they are affecting our everyday lives and establishing channels for us to connect, to find and share information, and to build agency and initiatives around issues of importance is critical in order to feel that we are having an impact, that we are empowered to work on issues so that we can affect decision-making and education. The slogan, education can be a driver for change, requires for us educators to have a careful look also on our sort of own ways of doing, how we are teaching in our programs, what is the research based that we are relying on, how do we choose what we focus on, how do we cultivate global citizenship skills, competencies, how do we ensure that our students, the becoming teachers or experts, have this multicultural, multilingual awareness and appreciation of these issues and the environmental awareness that we do need. How do we make the practices of democracy education and to be sort of lived experience and have an impact in our lives, and sensitize ourselves to issues of sustainable living, equality and justice. So the CloseNet network is formed to become a home for education, research, and action around these issues, this sort of like diversity of issues. And it aims to strengthen a community which is already there, but we would like to make it more visible, more sort of stronger. We have the yearly SDG in Chipomra, we have the Education for Emergencies Research, and we have this Critical Approaches Research Group, but we have had already some discussions with the wisdom community to be able to sort of have a bigger impact and connect with other universities and other countries as well. I don't know whether you had an opportunity to participate yesterday to the annual celebration of the University of Jyväskylä. Sanna Karpulehto gave an eloquent speech yesterday. She was the recipient of the yearly Science Communication Award. She's also the editor-in-chief of the online publication Wisdom Letters. And that publication is about sustainable development, sustainability transitions, and planetary well-being. And in her speech, she reminded us that action is demanded from all of us in order to maintain the diversity and well-being of the planet, but also the people, the inhabitants, whether animate or inanimate. And she sort of made the point that, well, we have to take care of our forests, our lakes, our mountains, our species, big and small. But action includes also practical recommendations that can be used in decision-making and education. That's where we need research. This week, there was also the publication of the newest issue of Wisdom Letters and a new edited book on sustainability, was also published yesterday. So there are things happening which we really want to sort of be part of making things sort of stronger, having this stream of things happening in the same direction. Sanna Karpulehto suggested that maybe we should change the phrase from the old seminary building. There's on this wall, there's this kind of like a banner saying that, well, we have to take care of the youth and their best. And she said, well, maybe we should not only strive towards the best future for our youth, but also for the planet, which I fully agree. But I also think that it implies that the youth that we're talking about are not only those closest to us. Our sort of responsibility extends to ensuring sustainability and better global justice and equality for children and youth in the world, which is in turmoil, but also changing, hopefully to become more open. I invite you all to this community. I'd like to see more of like shared initiatives, activities for research, development of educational modules, also with other universities. And with this webpage, we would like to exchange these opportunities of action to have a big impact. I extend my warmest thanks to Heidi and Kara and Joe and Nico and all the team of people who've been already organizing events, Abisa there too, and all the wonderful Daco people and Edema people. I think that you are the core of this kind of, I would say, it's a movement of like becoming more aware and making connections. So our students are very, very much in this together. And of course, we have the working group for internalization at the department. So what I think is important that we make these links, that we try to draw as many people along to sort of be a warm, inviting community. Thank you for all your being here. Now I hope that we have a good continuation and we keep on having these opportunities to come together. Now, hand over to Heidi. Thanks.
Thank you, Anna-Maija, for the warm welcome. And a little bit about the network. Those of you who took part to the SDG4 seminar, the team 2023 was from education for emergencies to the emergence of education. And kind of the emergence is also this network. It's something that is emerging from the SDG4 and also emerging from the need that we kind of need to rethink the education. And Anna-Maja already mentioned my first name. I think many of you know, but just in case I'm new to somebody, my name is Heidi Lane, and I'm a senior lecturer in sustainable and global education in the faculty. And network is never born alone. Like Anna-Maja said, we have our coordinator, Kara, here in our audience. And also our today's guest talk is by our very good colleague, Joe, who is also very actively part of our network. And since we started in the SDG4 seminar, now Joe will more talk about the emergence. Also, I would like to, this close-knit network, as it has emerged from our Education for Emergencies research project, which is still ongoing, and we are still working also towards building these websites, but we have this website for the network already existing, and it has a little bit of introduction, and when we were thinking about the name of this network, we had a difficulties like how do we bring it out so that, you know, kind of like that it is active, that the name has some kind of an activity. And that's how we came with the chains. And then also, I think the chains means different to everybody. And I was thinking before today's event, like, and we were also discussing about, you know, what the chains is, what is the type of change that is needed in education. And I believe that for many of us, maybe for all of us, the Brazilian critical pedagogist Paulo Freire is familiar to us and his work on the pedagogy for oppressed. And I'm thinking about in today's world, like thinking about, and the meaning behind was that he realized that, you know, the need for people to actually oppress others was kind of this fear that if we balance out the power, then those oppressed will take over the power and the oppression will shift to the other direction. We can also be oppressors in different ways. We can kind of oppress and know and do it and be part of that processes. We can also realize that it is happening, but we can be more passive and not reacting to it. We can also react, but not allowing and empowering those oppressed or taking those oppressed to the action with us. Or we can actually work on the change so that we work together to make the change. And that's kind of the way how I think about the change. And then also the Freire's idea was that when we do the education, that we try to educate in a way that it is not about a shift of the power balance, but it is actually that we start to work together and we create this more socially sustainable societies, socially sustainable futures. And he had also a dialogue as one big theme in a way behind the pedagogy. And that's also, I think, what Jo will bring in her today's talk. But a little intro to our website. Those of you who took part to the SDG4 seminar 2023, the keynotes are already here. So we have here different themes on anti-racism education, eco-pedagogy, education in emergencies, global citizenship education, peace education, pedagogical leadership during the times of emergencies, social inclusion and intercultural sustainability, well-being for and in emergencies. So, for example, if you click that open, you see Mia Sainio's keynote for the SDG4 2023 seminar, and you can listen. We have also reading resources under each theme. So this is also the site developed for teachers to be used here in the university, or in a upper secondary education level, or any education level that anybody feels that the material suits. So it's freely accessible to everybody, everybody. We have also our Education for Emergencies, but we have this teams or this global innovation network for teaching and learning, and our Education for Emergencies research is funded by Chintu. So we have also, we've worked with our Indian colleagues. The idea of the Chintu is to enhance and develop research and teaching collaboration with University of Uvascular coordinating the collaboration with India. So under BEATS Education, we have also lectures by our Indian colleagues. And then under the pedagogical leadership, we have from our Education for Emergencies last spring event, also our Indian colleagues, our Fulbright fellow. And then we have also some of the teaching materials under the anti-racism education. We have also completed, as a part of this close-knit network, a co-teaching pilot with the University of Helsinki. So we were piloting with our Eduma Deiko program and then changing education program in the University of Helsinki and anti-racism education course. And the students are doing really excellent coursework there. So we are hoping that we will get the permission from the students to have some of the materials here online. So this is how our network is kind of developing. We are developing these websites. We are inviting everybody to work with us and become part of our network. And let us know any ideas and suggestions on the website if you want to bring something in that is also possible. Now I would like to welcome first Kara to introduce our today's keynote.
Hi, my name is Kara Ranai, and I'm going to introduce today's speaker. Can you hear me clearly?
Okay. We have to go a little closer to the microphone.
A little bit closer. Yeah.
So our speaker today is Josephine Moat. She sees herself as an educational researcher and a teacher educator, but we also know her as a senior lecturer in bilingual and multilingual pedagogy in the Department of Teacher Education here at the University of Uvascular. Among her many research interests are teacher development and the role of language and culture in education. Her work is often formed by dialogical and ecological theorizations of education, for example, examining the underlying values and assumptions in education, as we're going to hear today, I'm sure. And she's very enthusiastically involved in the teaching and development of many programs in this faculty, including the International Master's Degree programs in our faculty, the Masters of Educational Sciences, and the Masters of Development, Education and International Cooperation. And of course, as you may have heard before, she's played an integral role in the SDG4 seminars that we've had in the past. So it's my pleasure to welcome you today, Jo. Please make her welcome.
So I haven't been overly nervous until that moment, but here, yourself being introduced. Thank you. Okay, so hello, so nice to see people here, so nice to also see people online. Thank you for coming. We're in this together. That was the title that came to mind when Heidi asked whether I would be willing to share today. And for me, somehow this, in some ways, it's a kind of obvious statement. Yeah, we're in this together, but really, we're in this together? How are we going to do this? How are we going to manage it? And so what I would like to share are some pedagogical reflections on being inside, outside, and alongside in education. These thoughts are partly based on my life experience of coming to Finland 26 years ago, and realizing that I am somewhere else, not least because it was midsummer day and there were lots of naked people walking around the forest. And I thought, where am I? Are we in this together? And yes, 26 years later, I don't consider myself a Finn. But when I go back to the UK, I'm not quite the English person that I was, don't quite fit in to English society there as well. So what does it mean? This insideness, outsideness, and I'm not offering final answers in any way, but hopefully that we can reflect together. And a pedagogical reflection really draws on the notion of pedagogy, which is this idea of walking alongside. And originally it was the slave of the household that delivered the oldest or the son of the house to the place of learning, which in some ways is not a positive image for educators. I don't mean to suggest that educators are slaves or should be, but on the other hand, I think this idea of accompanying somebody to a place of learning is a very important metaphor. But as educators, we can't guarantee, we can't determine what it's learned. There's some kind of mystery involved in it. People learn things that we don't intend, and people don't learn things that we want them to learn. So there's this kind of mystery behind it. But nevertheless, it's a very important role. And as Van Manen says, it's about investing in the being and becoming of others. Being who you are now in this place is sufficient. This is a good thing, but it's also not the end of the story, that we are also becoming something more along the way. And education has this sort of practical ethics to it. Often in a classroom environment, educators are called to act in that moment. You can't say to the children, hold on, stop, I need to think about this and walk away and read something that might be inspiring and come back. You have to be able to act in that moment, which also means we need time when we can step away and think about things in order to be able to respond within the immediacy of the moment. So pedagogical reflection is a kind of careful deliberation in response to the call to act. So my experiences partly inform this personally, but also through professional experiences that I've had working with some wonderful international colleagues and students through one of the projects named In Out. It was actually Inside Out, Outside In, Building Bridges with Diversity in Teacher Education. And the idea was to try and encourage student teachers to find ways of working well with people who struggled in education, people who found themselves on the outside, but also to recognise that education doesn't just take place on the inside. There is also education that takes place outside the institutional environment of a school or a college or wherever we may be. But this was a very important project for me, interdisciplinary colleagues coming together, arts-based methodologies. Some of these things will come through in this talk now. And at the time of initiating the other project, we recognised that the increasing diversity called on us as educators to do something. We had to do better than we had been doing previously. And in the meantime, there has been also the pandemic, where many more people, many more children have found themselves outside of school. And many of these learners will not find their way back into school again. So that the need, the emergency has grown much greater. And also within Finland as well, there has been a lot of talk recently about this decrease in learning outcomes, that children in Finnish schools are not doing as well as they were previously doing. But what does that mean? What are we actually reading into these results? One of the questions I would raise about that is what do we expect from young people when we use, for example, international tests as a measure of their success in school? I don't know about the circles that you move in, but the 15-year-old boys that I know would not actually care very much about PISA. And even if you make the test part of their everyday life, they're not going to go into that test situation and do their best. They are going to go into that test situation because they have no choice, and they will get out as quickly as they can. And yet then the wider educational community, hello.
I think your screen is not sharing on Zoom. Can I just
go for it? I don't know whether I'll get my flow back then.
That's okay. No, it's in the PowerPoint. Then you have to share in it.
Go for that one, please.
Mm-hmm. Now this is the PowerPoint one, not the Zoom one.
That the Zoom one.
Yeah. Now you have to go to the Zoom one and change the slides in the Zoom version.
Will you change?
Yes.
Mentally recapping. So 15-year-old boys don't really care so much about PISA, at least the ones that I have in my life. And yet we spend a lot of time focusing on what they produce in the test rather than necessarily who and how they are in their lives. So what do we expect young people, children, adults as well, to invest in education? And what if actually the education that we're offering them leads to some kind of resignation, some kind of like passivization, that they actually step back from the world? Surely education should be about making the world bigger. It should be about making that connection with the world richer, opening up new possibilities and new opportunities, not closing them down, not pacifying them, which in turn would impoverish their own lives, but also the wider life, what it means to be in this together. So the underlying questions that I'm hoping I address now in these few minutes is, how can insideness and outsideness be understood? What are different ways in which it can be understood? How can insideness and outsideness be understood in education? And what does it mean to have insideness and outsideness as part of a community? And that brings us then to considering, what does alongsideness mean? I'm sure if I asked you, everybody could explain what outsideness means to them. And it might be that outsideness is a very liberating experience. You don't have restrictions on you. You're free to move. You're free to do as you deem necessary or would like to in those moments. But on other occasions, outsideness comes with a great weight, at a great cost. You don't know what is coming, but you know it is something negative. It has a very great weight that lands upon you. But of course, outsideness is very often a matter of perspective, where you're looking from, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing in that moment. In the In-Out project that I referred to, we invited the student teachers to reflect on insideness and outsideness at the start of the project, before they had met together, and then during the project. And it perhaps won't surprise you to know that after the project, they were also asked to reflect on insideness and outsideness as well. And at the beginning of the project, they described insideness as that which was familiar, my group, my friends, my family, somewhere where we share the same passions and interests, a place of big belonging, being connected, this safe, assured, accepted, respected, rooted, welcome home, nice in big letters. Over time, thinking about insideness a little bit more, they began to realise that actually insideness is often something that's bestowed. It's something that's given rather than something that can be taken. In that way, a way in is needed. Somebody else has to open the door that this becomes possible. And it also makes insideness into a kind of bounded or boundaried entity. Later on, the student teachers, many of them reflected on how actually insideness can be a transitory thing. It doesn't last unendingly. It can be quite tenuous. The connections can break quite easily. It can also quite unfairly and unequally bestow privilege. It can be abused. It's not sufficient in and of itself to always stay inside. It's restrictive. It can trap and induce the adoption of inappropriate behaviour or dangerous habits that shouldn't be accepted without question. It also requires some kind of commitment. It's not something that can always be assumed. And in that way, it requires ongoing reflection. What do we belong to? Why are we here? And it is also something that can be opted out of. Well, the outsideness perspective of the student teachers also had a richness to it. Initially, outsideness was presented as almost the opposite to insideness. So this is entering a new space, new activities, new people and relationships. This is going outside of my comfort zone. And it was often associated actually with some kind of agony and exhaustion were the first responses. A reduction in confidence that even though I'm the same person now in this new place, I don't feel like me anymore. Somehow exposure, vulnerability, feeling stressed, unwelcome, uncomfortable, overwhelmed, rejected, confused. Although some also recognise there can be peace and freedom in stepping outside of a familiar space. Again, with some more thoughtful reflections on this, they began to recognise the generative potential of outsideness, that maybe perhaps the exhaustion is in part because of the increased awareness, the greater consciousness that is required when we're in a new place, a new environment. And in that way, new perspectives, new opportunities, new reflections, new acquaintances open up. It can be through these difficult experiences that we develop greater empathy for other people. And it also provides an opportunity, impetus even, for change and development. And in many of the reflections, there was a sense of epiphany that this wasn't a nice place to be, but now I see there was something of value in it. And this quotation here from one of the student teachers seemed to capture quite nicely their realization that, for example, I myself like the feeling of insideness, belonging to a group and to feel safe. But sometimes in my life, the experiences of being outside, often these were the moments in my life which made me grow. So in that way, the initial sort of negativity associated with outsideness has a different hue, a different colour associated with it. In the project, my geographer colleague introduced a framework from another geographer, Edward Ralph. This is a kind of pathway that mediates the way from space to place, that initially existential outsideness, Ralph suggests, is a feeling of unrealness, non-belonging, of placelessness. Where am I now? And that existential outsideness can become a form of objective outsideness, a kind of so what attitude, a kind of defensive, yeah, why, whatever, which can also become an incidental outsideness, that you're physically present in a place, but there is no emotional attachment to it, which can also then become a form of vicarious outsideness. So through, for example, the arts, through different kinds of activities, we begin to engage with the place through a second-hand experience, which in turn can then become a form of behavioural insideness, where you're able to look around. You maybe don't yet feel like you belong, but you can see more in this place, and then become a kind of empathetic insideness, which allows you to deliberately, be present, to recognise that perhaps you have something to give here, something to contribute, which can become, lead to a kind of existential insideness in which there is a deep sense of assumed identity. The connection between the individual and the environment, it's so intense that it's difficult to separate the two, which perhaps explains why existential outsideness can be so unreal and unsettling, surreal even. But if your identity is so deeply rooted in a place from which you were then taken out, especially if not by your will, and then placed somewhere else, you are wondering, where on earth am I? What can I do here? I found this framework to be quite powerful, actually, in helping me to understand partly my experiences, but also to recognize the experiences of others. For example, the defensiveness of the so what attitude. Ralph suggests that it's through experiences we develop this sense of place, a sense of belonging. But I would suggest that there is a little bit more to it than just experience. And even with a wonderful framework like this, we need to be a little bit careful, because existential insideness, which is somehow presented here as a positive idea, also has a question mark over it. And from a dialogic perspective, you could say that a system to which individuals involuntarily, unconsciously, perhaps even effortlessly attached, this model, Bakhtin would say, does an injustice to the very hard and particularized work required of each one of us to achieve a responsible position in the world. So the problem, or a problem, with existential insideness is that it takes us in so completely that we no longer have to think, who are we? How are we? And how are we going to relate to the others? Because it now becomes a given. Educational psychologist Bruna has commented that in education, we seem too often to be prone to acting our way into implicit thinking than we are able to think our way explicitly into acting. We continue to do what we have done because we do what we have done because we do what we have done. And he says that if we are not aware of the what and why and how, we cultivate a mindlessness that in the end reduces our own humanity and fosters cultural division, all kinds of different division, even when it is not intended. So this dichotomy of insideness, outsideness, is it quite so stark, and should it be placed in those terms? As I've been thinking through these issues, I have come up with more and more questions. And I have to say, the more I think about these things, the more questions that come up. On the one hand, the existential outsideness becomes a kind of alienation. That who are we on this, in this space? And then the existential insideness is this kind of consummation that we kind of get absorbed into it. When I was thinking about this, I had this idea of my compost bin, which isn't composting so well at the moment, but it will do in the summer, whereby the individual pieces are put into the compost, but then they break down into the soil. That's great for the garden. It's not so great for the individual. We don't want to decompose into a place. So what is it? Why are we saying that outsideness is necessarily a deficiency? Is it that we consider outsideness in education a deficiency? If you're outside, you're a problem. If you're outside, we really need to get you inside so you stop being a problem. When we've got everybody inside, everything will be fine. Is that really progress? Is it possible for insideness and outsideness somehow to coexist, to somehow be co-present, to somehow be mutually beneficial to one another? I think, I hope that somehow there the alongsideness would come in. I've included this quotation from a student teacher reflecting on the In Out project, which had a 10-day intensive program. And she comments that when I got home, though, I didn't really feel like home anymore. Some part of me had changed and I'd learned and experienced things with people who weren't surrounding me anymore. And this made me feel a bit of an outsider. And this really confused me. I think this quote is quite wonderful for showing that it can be within quite a small space of time that quite profound change can take place in both relationships and also associations with place. But many of the student teachers came out of this project with really noble goals. They wanted to be aware of and preserve students' identities. They wanted to recognize the uniqueness and establish an inclusive, welcoming atmosphere. They wanted to help pupils experience a sense of existential insideness. You belong here. They wanted, as educators, to be responsible, sensitive examples available to students in order for their pupils to also learn to value diversity and to be inclusive. So as I say, there were noble goals, and they even referred to their mission as educators. For example, some said that when people are included to the process, then they have the opportunity to feel as insiders. Our communication skills, temperament, cultural background, creativity, all our background makes us insideness of humanity. We're in this together. Another wrote that it is time for education to invite learners to the inside. It is time for education to have purpose, for how are they else to create an environment that invites learners to create their own educational identity and sense of place? And then one student wrote that I myself view insideness as something positive people should try to reach. An important aspect of insideness is the safe frame it can give you. We feel safe and enclosed. We are much more willing to stay at the place where we are and to develop. And in all honesty, who can find fault with these varied strong statements of good intent? These student teachers, they want to do well. They hope to open up classrooms. They want to welcome outsiders in, to be responsible gatekeepers, as it were, and to challenge established norms. And I have to say that these good intentions resonate with me. But in all honesty, I also find these statements quite disconcerting. There is something worrying even. And I have now for years had an uncomfortable feeling that something, even with all of this good intention, is not quite right. For example, are these future teachers in danger of being exhausted by their good intentions? It's all very well and good saying, yeah, I'm going to open the door until you get to the classroom. And it's like, whoa, this was not what I was expecting. Are they hoping to give more than is possible? Are they in danger of being disappointed of their ideals if they're not realized? Are they in danger of doing damage despite their good intentions? Okay, I need a drink of water. You can just think. So in trying to somehow address these concerns, I've been reading and thinking and looking in different places, and educational philosopher Biesta has, for me, raised many new questions and perspectives. And one of his recent publications comments about the challenges of a pedagogy of empowerment, which I think the student teachers here had really caught hold of. And Biesta comments that whereas a pedagogy of empowerment seeks to prepare students for their encounter with others, a pedagogy of disarmament seeks to open students for the encounter itself, so to speak, on the assumption that too much empowerment may get in the way of the encounter itself. In the earlier extracts from the student teachers, is it possible that their very good, very strong intentions could actually get in the way of them being able to realise those ideals? Biesta suggests it's problematic if approaches suggest it's possible to be prepared for encounters, to envisage the whole question from the perspective of the self who in some way is going to encounter another. Biesta comments that what is strange about such a depiction is that it puts the self in some kind of sovereign position. The educator becomes some kind of sovereign from which he or she can then decide whether or not to encounter this other and whether or not to engage in communication with this other. After all, what if this other bumps into me? What if this other takes the initiative? What if this other asks me a question? What if this other puts me in question? Or what if this other just puts up a middle finger in front of my face? What are we going to do?
Yeah.
Well, for me, this outsideness, I have to say, for quite a long time, was kind of confusing or uncomfortable. I was trying to find my place, my way within the system that I was based. And then I came across this quotation from Bakhtin, which I use on all possible occasions when I can. And it says that outsideness is a powerful factor in understanding. It is only in the eyes of another culture that foreign culture reveals itself fully and profoundly. We raise new questions for a foreign culture, ones that it did not raise itself. We seek answers to our questions in it, and the new culture responds to us by revealing to us its new aspects and new semantic depths. Such a dialogic encounter of two cultures does not result in merging or mixing. Each retains its own unity and open totality, but they are mutually enriched. So what do we have here? The idea that outsideness is a resource for better understanding. On the outside, you're not necessarily deficit. You still have something to contribute. You can still be somebody of value within the wider community. It is a position of outsideness can still be this place of positive contribution. And that for me was really, I would say in some ways, liberating. I don't have to just try to fit the mold. I don't mean that you can just disregard everything else. This is about trying to find out different ways of being and then asking questions of others that then they could enter into a dialogue with you and also see in a new way. And it doesn't mean that we would then all end up the same, a kind of grey mix rather than having all the beauty of different colours. But it means that we would gain, each of us, through this kind of encounter. Further on a dialogic perspective, the necessity of incompleteness, that each of us is incomplete alone, but we should rejoice in that incompleteness. Somehow that rejoice word always surprises me. It makes others more necessary to us, and it makes our tolerance of them more attractive. We need other people. That's the way it is. I am necessary to you and you to me because I can see what is going on behind your head, whereas you cannot. I know me from the inside. What it feels like to be Josephine, you know me from the outside. And through those ideas, I get to know more about myself. So as Sullivan says, we depend on others to find a sense of ourselves. But while we may come to know ourselves from the outside, we may also feel that our outside perspective does not adequately meet our inner sense of self. So we don't just say, okay, tell me who I am. Give me now my identity. But it's more that, okay, so this is the way you see me. is that who I am? I have to say, it's a surreal experience hearing Cara's introduction now. It was a bit like, is that me? Do I now stand up? We come to know ourselves from the outside and from the inside. And each of us has a uniqueness. We are without alibis. There is nobody else that can take your place, neither in space nor time, nor take your potential. There's this ability to encounter the uniqueness of others, to both be enriched and to enrich others. But there is also, of course, the possibility of impoverishing or decomposing another. Lacan actually uses the word of consummation, and he says that if we assume that we know everything about somebody else, it is a kind of consummation. And in effect, that's a kind of death. We're saying there is nothing else I can learn about you. There is nothing else that you can give to me. You're kind of complete. I find that quite a terrifying prospect. Well, how often do we do that? That we assume that we know somebody else in their entirety, and that's the end of the conversation. I'd like to change direction just a little bit and take a glimpse into a multicultural classroom. This comes from a master's thesis done 2 years ago here in our faculty, a special education student who was very interested in language and community in schools. And she went and carried out an ethnographic study in a first grade of 20 children in a diverse socioeconomic area in Finland. Some of the pupils were born here, some were newly arrived, some had lived overseas for a time, all were learning English as part of the curriculum, and studying through Finnish was mandatory for everybody. And the languages of the class were Finnish, Arabic, Albanian, English, Spanish, Russian, French, and Somali. So a whole range of different languages. The teacher had been interviewed about this class, and she said that this really is a positive environment. This is a nice place to work with these children. Although, she said, we've had a kind of rule that you can only speak a language that everyone understands in class. Sometimes it sounds a bit harsh to me, says the teacher, that you can't speak your native language, or it came from another Finnish language teacher who is in our class quite a lot. And she says that it's often agreed that the class speaks the common language in which you also study. And then I'm like saying that everyone knows you can't then speak your own language. So it went from a setting in which all of the children had access to different languages in different ways and on different levels. But then when this rule was introduced, all of a sudden, some of the children were dropped out of the conversation because they didn't have the same language repertoire. Their Finnish wasn't good enough to keep up. Okay, when they spoke Finnish, the others in the class pretty much understood, but it didn't mean that they could participate fully. And it meant that all of the different resources were kind of put under the feet. They were hidden from view, became invisible. And this rule then comes out in the different activities and relationships of the classroom. In interviewing in small group interviews with the Finnish speaking students, they reiterated several times speaking of the multilingual children. Even though they speak Finnish very well, they just speak whatever other language. Even though we have said you are not allowed to speak that outside, otherwise speak Finnish so everyone understands. So they know Finnish really well. They want no one to understand what they are talking about. We have this kind of suspicion coming in now. If they speak this other language, that means that they're somehow hiding something. Everyone must speak Finnish at school. It became a very kind of strong rule, and there came this kind of authority with it, that you're not allowed to do that, that the young children were echoing and repeating. And in the field notes that the researcher notes, she was in a class, in a Finnish language class, and she was translating for a multilingual student the words of a book so that the child it would make the reading easier for the child to understand the text. But then a native speaking Finnish student interrupts the conversation and firmly says to us, in Finnish, only Finnish is spoken in our class, and then leaves. Now the child who's putting in the rule is working correctly according to the rules of the classroom. That's what's supposed to happen. But what really is actually happening within the community here is these different boundaries are being put in place. It's perhaps unsurprising that outside of the classroom, the students with different language backgrounds tried to find people who shared the same language to be able to play with. They wanted to then come together. And in the field notes, the researcher comments that the friends with the same language seemed to bring joy and comfort to the everyday lives of multilingual students. meaning that in the same classroom together, they didn't find that joy and comfort. They had to seek for it elsewhere. And also the multilingual students, they were also picking up on this, that at recess we have a secret language. It becomes something that is hidden, becomes something that's kind of illicit. Again, it's reinforcing the boundary. You can speak your own language during recess. It's this kind of separation of us and them, even within this small community. And it comes out in other ways as well, that this is a sad little example. Three students with the same language are playing together in the yard, using their shared language. And then student seven, who didn't have any friends in the same language at the school, was excluded from the play. But student seven would like to play with a skipping rope, and the others won't agree. So the researcher goes over to see what's happening. And there's some disagreement that has student seven actually even come over to suggest playing with the rope. Maybe the child felt like it made quite a big gesture. Come on, let's play with the rope. And the others have just kind of ignored it. It hadn't registered with them. But anyway, the three students who speak the same language talk to each other until they decide that actually, well, no one wants to play skipping rope. So there you go. And it's just another boundary that's being reinforced in that environment. What could have been a coming together across a shared moment actually becomes a greater separation between the two. I have just one more particularly sad example to share, and I'll try to go on to happier things. But the irony of this comes from Wellbeing Week, which of course is very important at the moment. We should all be doing well in so many different ways. There was Wellbeing Week in the school, and the teacher says, we won't have the sports lesson. We're going out into the forest. And pupil seven turns to the researcher, who's now this trusted adult, and says, why not the gymnasium? Which forest? And the researcher explains, this is Wellness Week. This is Finland. That's why we're going to the forest. Pupil seven asks for permission to go to the toilet. I can see that he's annoyed. And when pupil seven comes back to the class, the child still looks sad. So the researcher asks him to stay out of the class and asks what's annoying. Pupil seven can't explain properly, not in Finnish. So I say, is it difficult to tell in Finnish? Yes. Would you like to say in Spanish? And relief comes on the face of the child. He says he's been really looking forward to the sports class and had brought new indoor sports clothes, especially. And then we discuss for a moment in Spanish. And then I ask the child, will you be able to continue for an hour? And the child says, yes, it's art, I can. And then he's still asking, but when is the sports class? Because that's what's important to him. That's become a feature of his landscape. The child goes back, but he can't concentrate. And after a few minutes comes back to the researcher and then somehow finds it possible to say, okay, I'm going to calm down now. And somehow this child is exercising such agency to try to navigate this environment and this sort of positive feature which was there. And I'm sure the teacher will have just thought it will be good for the kids. The kids will be excited to go to the forest instead of having sports. It will be fine. Not realizing that because the child is new to this place and this had become an established feature, to take it away was really painful. So it raises the question, can struggles be part of community? And in response to this, I find the work of Parker Palmer quite fascinating. And he comments that community is vital and important, terribly difficult, and something we're really not very well prepared for. And he shares of his own experience of going to a college, living there for a year. And he said at the end of the year, he came up with this definition. Community is that place where the person you least want to live with always lives. And at the end of the second year, he added something. And when that person moves away, someone else arises immediately to take his or her place. This community business, it's not easy. Nevertheless, Palmer argues that a healthy community includes conflict at its very heart. Checking, correcting, enlarging the knowledge of individuals by drawing on the knowledge of the group. Through this, community conflict is kind of a public encounter by which the whole group can win. And I think you can see that in those examples from the first grade classroom, that if it had become an opportunity to bring this out, that look, we're putting up walls here, what can we do about it? Is it not okay that sometimes children would use different languages? They're not talking about you, they're talking about their work or their games. And this actually also turns to the importance of the teacher, which is perhaps where the pedagogical reflection also comes in. because despite the difficulties that the children were experiencing, they still always wanted to turn to the teacher. In the group interview with the Finnish-speaking children, one of them said, "I sometimes find it difficult to understand the task, and I don't know, and if I don't know, I will ask the teacher." One of the bilingual children says, "If I need help, I will go to the teacher and ask her to translate." In the canteen, when a child was trying to speak to a new child who didn't learn no Finnish very well, and the conversation was initiated through Finnish, and every time the child initiated, the other child would put their hands over their ears and not want to listen. To try and understand this situation, the child initiating went to the teacher to ask, "What is happening? Why is this child doing this?" And it turned out in the interview with this child that they just kept reiterating, "I don't speak Finnish, I don't speak Finnish." And this was just the defensiveness, just trying to survive in this space to put up some kind of rules. Well, what is then this pedagogical alongsideness? The teacher, Biester again says, is not the one who explains the intercultural encounter. And in this regard, the teacher does not occupy a third person perspective. So it's not that a teacher should come in and say, "Now look, you're having difficulties because of some kind of, I don't know, existential outsideness. And then we need to sort this out." The teacher also, though, does not occupy the same, is also not the student. And in this regard, also does not occupy a first person perspective. The teacher's perspective in that classroom, in that community, is not the same as the child's. The teacher occupies a kind of second person perspective, the we perspective, which is both essential, needed to try to work this out, and should also become superfluous. So the relationships that are being established should then become self-sustaining over time. And Hicks comments that in these ethical kind of encounters, it really involves seeing or understanding in a way that tries to encompass another individuated subject. So to bring in another individual into a value system that does not diminish the individual or, as Bakhtin warned, impoverish or decompose individuals. So what could alongsideness be considered to be? I think it's not just sympathising, nor is it ignoring, nor is it feeling uncomfortable on somebody else's behalf. It also isn't about being fully prepared, that, "All right, I know what to do here, let's sort this out." But it is about being present, about being available somehow in that place. It's about asking honest questions, which I think as educators we're not that good at doing, because often we ask questions fully knowing the answer that we want to get. So how do we ask honest questions that really invite people to share their experiences? Or if they're not able to put it into words, how can we watch and observe what is going on, to read the situation, not to assume we get it all, but to better understand maybe what is happening here, to come alongside. Alongsideness also involves drawing and directing attention. The work of teachers draws and directs attention, whether we intend it to or not. You could see how the young children in the earlier extract started to impose the rule that was given. Maybe the rule was given with the good intention, it's very important for the students who are learning Finnish to use Finnish as much as possible. I think it was probably born out of that good intention, and also that it would be open for everybody in the classroom, not realising that at the same time it put some people very much at the bottom of the pile. So how to draw attention to different ideas, different possibilities, different potentials, and to also recognise that there is a mystery, as I said at the beginning, involved in learning. We're not going to get it all right. We don't know it all. And there is even some kind of violence in learning. When you really learn something, when something really goes deep, it can be really disorientating. You know, some kind of ideas, new ideas, can kind of shock and disturb. It's not always a nice experience. And learning doesn't always have to start with me, with my interests. But sometimes it's more important to look at what are the experiences, the interests, the questions of others, rather than starting with mine. I'm coming towards the end. But what could perhaps create communities that nourish those on the inside and the outside? These are my thoughts at the moment, that recognising the value of each other within a community must be important. This fundamental need for one another, meeting with others, it doesn't reduce who I am to meet with somebody else. It should enrich. And then approaching others without suspicion, but not with a kind of blind trust that this is going to go perfectly well. because neither of those starting points are helpful, but to recognise that building a community together requires some kind of investment. It's going to involve some kind of vulnerabilities. We need some kind of shared ground rules. We need to be prepared to reconsider and find alternatives. And recognising that educational communities don't pre-exist. The SDG4 network doesn't exist. It can't be imposed or demanded, but it takes shape through the network of relationships that exist and develop over time. So I think maybe this requires a new way of thinking, some kind of new metaphors. And even walking into Ruusupuisto today, now I saw some kind of, was it eco-community or different kind on the other side of this board here? I think that this is striking many people, different forms of sustainability. But this idea comes again from Palmer, who uses the metaphor of a tree going through the different seasons to try to understand how we in life go through different seasons. We have winters, which feel like a dying back, a kind of dormancy, a lack of action, which paradoxically then turn into a spring of this new life coming, where something new comes out, which can then lead to a summer of kind of flourishing, in which some kind of harvest is developed, which can then be shared, some kind of bounty, which then goes again to some kind of dormancy, even some kind of death. So we've got this ongoing sort of seasonal pattern, which is full of paradox, and actually reminded me of a very often quoted line from Bakhtin, this idea of an answer does not give rise to a new question from itself. It falls out of the dialogue and enters systemic cognition, which is essentially impersonal. If our answers don't give rise to new questions, so if I'm saying an answer is alongsideness, that should hopefully raise all kinds of new questions that we can start to think about. And for me, that's been partly thinking about how insideness and outsideness can coexist. And in this example here of a tree, biologist Alan Rayner describes this as a solar-powered fountain in which the water is drawn up through the roots due to the power of the sun. It rises through the conduits of the tree, held in by the bark, through the branches, through the leaves, and then transpires into the environment. Oh, I'm pressing the wrong arrow. And then the moisture is then released into the atmosphere, which then continues the cycle. And here we have a flow of energy that is fostered, enabled through the insideness, outsideness of this being. The tree cannot be separated from the environment without coming to harm. The environment without the tree would also be lesser. Somehow there is this ongoing relationship that is incredibly important. And I realise that as people, we have multiple insidenesses and outsidenesses. We're not just like a tree, which has this more complex, beyond my understanding of biological insideness, outsideness. But somehow I find this flow of energy to be a very powerful idea, and to recognise that all living systems somehow need to be able to attune to their activities and development in relation to the energy available in the local habitat. So what energy do we provide in education? What do we allow to flow between us? Community cannot for long feed on itself. It can only flourish from the coming of others from beyond their unknown and undiscovered others. What an exciting attitude that would be if when a new person came to the class, it wasn't, oh, well, how are we going to manage now? But wow, what more can we do now? So receiving and expending energy is the primary need to sustain life. Competitive advantage, selfish hoarding, depleting neighbourhoods, keeping hold of resources, that doesn't allow for flourishing. That doesn't perpetuate life. For resilient, healthy communities, we need biodiversity, not any kind of monoculture. So what kind of energy, attunement, relationships, flourishing, what is enabled in educational communities? Final slide. Whether we like it or not, I think we're in this together. We have to get rid of any idea of survival of the fittest, to sustainability through fitting. Not this mixing and merging, becoming the same, but finding a way to rub alongside and to get alongside with one another. 10 years ago, Stephen Chemist gave a wonderful keynote here in Ueskula, and he a very important statement from his talk and work is learning to live well in a world worth living in. We're in this together. So the co-presence and multiplicity of insideness and outsideness is inevitable,
I don't think we should strive to get rid of outsideness, although I don't think that putting people and leaving people on the outside alone is a healthy place to be. Nor do I think that remaining on the inside and trying to get everybody inside in the same way is a healthy way to be. But somehow it's through alongsideness, a healthy flow of energy, reciprocal relationships, potential that sustains and develops community. Thank you.